This weekend starts right after this.
Support for This Morning with Gordon Deal comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. Go to rocketmortgage.com/Gordon.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Preparing for portfolio shock. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Kashenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
With the enormous swings of the stock market lately, how prepared are your savings accounts to absorb the shock? Hear advice from the pros.
Fears over North Korea's nuclear program have led to a spike in the sales of survivalist gear. Find out what people are buying.
At the movies, Disney is seeking a new kind of blockbuster. We'll explain the marketing strategy for Black Panther.
And where American skiers have their biggest fans.
Although the United States has a great ski team, particularly women, they don't have a ton of fans relative to Europe, which is really the historic hub of alpine skiing, downhill skiing. So what I found is that a lot of, for instance, heads of the fan clubs of Lindsey Vonn and Michaela Schifrin are actually in Germany and Austria and other places like that.
Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman is in South Korea covering the Olympics. Her story is later in the hour. Another 175 people will die today from an opioid overdose. Some argue we won't get a handle on the epidemic until there's a serious commitment to solving it. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who headed the president's opioid commission, remembers marches in every major U.S. city during the AIDS crisis, with people asking the government to find a way to stem the deaths. He wonders where the marches are for this. It's a story by Jerry Mitchell, investigative reporter at the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. Jerry, put the stats in perspective.
It keeps increasing exponentially, the number of people that are dying. It's over, in 2016, you know, over something like about 64,000 Americans. Like you said, 175 a day, which that's like a jumbo jet crashing, you know, every day. And what would we do if a jumbo jet was crashing every day? Or that'd probably be a 737, actually. But, you know, if they crashed every day full, I mean, what would we do? We'd shut down airplanes and we'd figure this thing out. But there's just not been the response to this that there would have been in a situation like that, or a situation if this were Ebola virus that was going wild throughout the country. I mean, what would we do? I mean, we would move heaven and earth to do something about it. But there just hasn't been the dedication to it, at least so far.
Boy, solutions could be what here? Anybody float anything that caught your attention?
You know, it would be easier if there was one solution. It kind of has to be multifaceted, and that's kind of what the experts we talked about. One is, and I think, well, the guy who wrote probably the most definitive book on this, Dreamland, his opinion is we need a Marshall Plan. We need a Marshall Plan like attack to the opioid epidemic. And that's the opinion of most of the people, the experts that I've talked to, that we're going to have to invest a lot in, for example, drug treatment. We're just going to have to get as many Americans as we can off these opioids that don't need them, really. They're addicted or dependent on them. I'm not talking about people that have cancer or, you know, serious illnesses or anything. Not talking about those folks. You're talking about people who don't need them to survive.
Right.
And then the other thing is you're going to have to make buprenorphine, or sometimes called Suboxone is the brand name that people probably are more familiar with. You have to make some of those available. You're going to make that available and make it cheap so that people will take those. If it's not cheap, then people who are addicted may, unfortunately, revert to heroin, which is cheap, or fentanyl and things like that, which fentanyl especially is killing like more than 20,000 people a year.
That's incredible. When somebody says or proposes to invest in drug treatment, what does that mean? Or you represent a little bit, I guess, more medicine, like a physical...
I've talked to think the wisest course, because just the cost would be outpatient-type drug treatment rather than, I'm talking about inpatient. And there may be some people that need inpatient. I'm not saying that, but that in terms of getting your most effective means of getting to the most people.
Yeah.
And I think that would mean that they're going to have to see doctors, and they're going to see doctors who specialize in this. And it's just going to have to be a concerted effort, at least the experts I've talked to try and do something about that. And, of course, you've got to make naloxone available to law enforcement, people that do overdose. We don't want people dying. Even law enforcement have overdosed, not on purpose, but because they're having to deal with such dangerous drugs as fentanyl. And just if that even gets through your skin, you can overdose.
It's incredible.
I mean, you know, you're a law enforcement person, you know, dealing with these things.
We're speaking with Jerry Mitchell, investigative reporter at the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. He's written a piece for USA Today entitled, "With 175 Americans Dying a Day, What Are the Solutions to the Opioid Epidemic?" Finish up here with maybe the pharmaceutical company's role in all this, or what they might be asked to do.
Well, there's a multi-district litigation basically happening in terms of, like last year, there were 250 lawsuits filed against these pharmaceutical companies and related companies. And so they're suing, and so you've got the cities, counties, states are all suing them. And so this is gathered right now. A lot of them are, about 200 of them are gathered in this multi-district litigation. And there's potentially going to be a settlement. I don't know. I can't say definitively, but everybody remembers the tobacco settlement. Everybody remembers the tobacco settlement. Remember the tobacco companies were being sued by all the states. Mm-hmm. And so they kind of came together and had an agreement, and they settled, and there were, you know, payments to all the states for people that they had to treat for tobacco. I wouldn't be surprised if that's what happens here, that there ends up being a huge settlement with these pharmaceutical companies, and perhaps the money would go toward just what we're talking about, drug treatment and some of these other areas where it's needed.
Thanks, Jerry. Good story. Jerry Mitchell, investigative reporter at the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Support for This Morning, America's First News with Gordon Deal, comes from Health IQ. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people, including runners, cyclists, strength trainers, vegans, and more. 56% of Health IQ customers save between 4 and 33% on their life insurance. These savings are exclusive to Health IQ. Like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, Health IQ saves you money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle. To see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/Gordon or mention the promo code Gordon when you talk to a Health IQ agent. Hey, glad you could join us. The question that often emerges about sexual harassment is why, as in why do people do it? Psychologists are offering explanations. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
High-powered men accused of abusing women may have different motivations, but they often share personality traits. Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal has taken a look at this and joins us now. Elizabeth, how does power play a role here?
Well, it's fascinating. Power gives men access to women, of course, but the research shows that it's a little more complicated. Power is isolating. People with great power feel rules don't apply to them. There's a lot of enablers around. But there's research that shows that it's something else. There's men who feel an extreme lack of power, very disempowered earlier in life, and then achieve great power, those are the ones that this research is showing are more likely to mistreat women when they do get that power.
And you touched on it, Elizabeth. What kinds of people do they surround themselves with then?
Surround themselves with yes people, enablers, people who are going to tell them what they want to hear often, but more than that, who will look away when they see the bad behavior. So when you see something, some of these companies where the person at the top, the man at the top, has really been mistreating women, is a harasser, assaulter, usually that's pretty systemic. All the way down, people have been looking aside for many years.
How does power make people less inhibited?
it's like alcohol, really. So it amplifies what's already there. So if you already have these tendencies, it's going to amplify that. If you're a really nice person, if you're very compassionate, research shows that those people are the really good bosses. When they get power, they become more nice, more compassionate. But the opposite is true, too. So if you have sort of dark tendencies, if you're a man who has dark tendencies towards women, those are going to be amplified by power.
Elizabeth, in your research, the studies that you looked at, were they just taking a look at corporations, at settings in a workforce?
No, they were really looking at all types of men. So they're looking at frat boys. They were looking at people, you know, in power in corporations. Really, the studies that we looked at thousands of men over decades and found specific personality traits over and over that the men who tend to be harassers and assaulters have.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Bernstein of the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, your story talks about the term hostile masculinity. What does that mean?
So there's two sets of traits in particular that these men who end up mistreating women egregiously have. One is hostile masculinity, and that's a set of traits that includes a tendency to find power over women to be a turn-on sexually. They feel anger at being rejected by a woman. Typically, these are men that this probably happened to a lot when they were younger. They justify their aggression, and they're often narcissists. So that is hostile masculinity.
And the other term was impersonal sexuality. What is that?
Exactly. Impersonal sexuality. These are people who prefer sex without intimacy or any kind of close connection, and this often makes them promiscuous. They also tend to come from a difficult home environment as a child and often had antisocial tendencies as an adolescent.
Elizabeth, you mentioned earlier that some of these men felt powerless before they got into a position of power. Does looks have anything to do with it?
It's interesting. I did ask that question a lot, and the researchers are interested in it, too, and there's no solid research on it, but they theorize that often, men who were rejected early, right? So if you're rejected early because of looks in adolescence and young men, that may play into it. But there are men who have been, there's very high-profile cases where men who have behaved very badly, and sometimes even assaulters, rapists, are very well-looking. Very good-looking. So, there's men like Matt Lauer, there's men like Kobe Bryant. These people are out there, and they're very, they're very good-looking.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal columnist Elizabeth Bernstein. 21 minutes after the hour on This Weekend.
My king, we are home. My son, it is your time.
I am ready. A war is coming.
Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business, Michigan. Contact michiganbusiness.org today. Hype is growing ahead of the new movie Black Panther. The Marvel film, opening next Friday, features one of the first black superheroes in comic books, and its resonance for African-American moviegoers is transforming a typical action movie rollout into a full-blown cultural event. Disney, which owns Marvel, hopes to translate that into the first international blockbuster whose cast and crew are mostly black. It's a story from Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter John Jurgensen. John, give us the setup.
Well, the setup is that there's no precedent, really, for what's happening with Black Panther. It's a major Disney-Marvel blockbustery marketed movie aimed at a global audience, starring a predominantly black cast and made by predominantly black filmmakers. It's never happened before in the Marvel Universe, and really it's hard to pinpoint a major studio tentpole film that fits that description either, too. So it's really kind of finding new territory in terms of what it's portraying, because it's not really, it's a superhero film. It's not a film about overcoming adversity in terms of racial oppression and things like that. It's a fantasy film starring a largely black cast. And there really isn't any kind of history for something like this. So it's creating a lot of excitement.
Interesting. So that could play differently in a global audience, given that this is a superhero movie.
Well, yeah, it's a superhero movie, which on one hand, those do really well in international commercial rollouts, and that's why we see so many of those things, because they do translate pretty well overseas. On the other hand, there's been a long history of films with minority cast members being downplayed overseas and not doing well overseas. And that's why studios don't release many of them, because they reason that those kind of films are not going to make money abroad. And that's where they get a lot of the majority of their ticket sales often come from overseas markets too. So that's been the kind of the bias against doing these kind of films in the past. And a lot of critics of that say that that's kind of a false equivalency. You know, if you don't try it, you don't know what really happens there. So this is going to be a big test. And so far, the tracking signs point to a huge release, at least domestically, because of the advanced ticket sales are already through the roof. And there's a lot of buzz for this film. But the international rollout is going to be the big question mark and kind of the test for this going forward. And a lot of people are hoping that if it does perform well abroad and all over the place, it's going to open the door for a lot more films that look this way.
Wow. Explain the interest, especially in the black community.
Yeah, there's a few prongs to that. On one hand, it's rallying around a black cast and filmmakers. You know, some of the biggest stars in movies right now are in this, and it's directed by Ryan Coogler, who's got a great track record of making strong films, although he's never made a superhero film before. So on one hand, it's kind of a traditional rally behind a black project. On the other hand, it's also showing, as I mentioned before, this kind of futuristic world where, you know, it's set in this African nation of Wakanda, which is a fictional place that's isolated but rich and technologically advanced. So it paints a picture of kind of this Afrofuturist world that isn't kind of mired in some of the stereotypes that we often see about black life, especially American black life in the movies. So it's really kind of putting a perspective on blackness that we haven't really seen before on a kind of big scale like this. And it's portraying, you know, these casts of strong, brilliant, fierce warriors and fighters and kings and royalty. And again, that's something that people in the African-American community feel like it's really underrepresented and sent a strong and good message.
How about that? We're speaking with Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter John Jurgensen. His piece is called In Black Panther, Disney Seeks New Kind of Blockbuster. You said, too, some folks are like coordinating outfits to wear on opening night, and there's going to be like a celebratory atmosphere.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, the buzz around this film is huge, and social media is really what's driving a lot of that.
Thanks, John. Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter John Jurgensen. The movie features Chadwick Boseman, Michael B. Jordan, Lupita Nyong'o, Forrest Whitaker, Angela Bassett. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit michiganbusiness.org. Thanks for being with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, how to make sure your portfolio is ready for a wild ride. Also, where American Olympic skiers have legions of enthusiastic fans. Hint, not the U.S. And the Olympic strategy, so radical, it just might work. That story in about 20 minutes. With reports about North Korea's improved rocket capabilities and a false incoming missile alert in Hawaii, surviving a nuclear attack has become a real consideration for some Americans. U.S. companies that provide survivalist gear and services have noted an uptick in sales and interest in their goods as we consider our level of preparedness, and government agencies encourage people to educate themselves on disaster response. It's a story from Laura Kelly, national and health reporter at the Washington Times. Laura, what are you hearing?
Well, I was first approached by this Israeli company that was developing this novel medication that can be used in case of a nuclear attack to help treat a large amount of people relatively quickly and easily. And At the same time, the Centers for Disease and Control and Prevention had said they wanted to do a lecture about nuclear preparedness. So there seemed to be a lot of talk of, you know, nuclear war in the air on top of the rhetoric between President Trump and North Korea's leader. And so talking with federal agencies and talking with this Israeli company, and then I reached out to some survivalist companies that said the public really responded to news reports when North Korea launched these nuclear or these missile tests. It really had them fearful and looking for the options of how they could keep themselves and their families safe.
So who's doing what? What are some of these companies making or offering?
Yeah, so a couple of these companies seem to have entered into this space of going beyond just camping survivalist gear, and they have gas masks, and they have these suits that protect you from chemical, biological, radiological warfare. Also, you can buy food that can last for up to 25 years in storage. And then things that people who just want to be prepared in case of a natural disaster and emergency, such as flashlights and hand crank radios. You want to have extra water on hand, water purifiers. And what was really interesting was this one man, actually, who had taken it a step further, the CEO of a company, Vivos, who is buying up these old military bunkers around the U.S. And actually around the world, and leasing out space to people who want to prepare in case they need a really safe place to go for an extended period of time.
I can imagine that some of the doomsday preppers that we've seen on TV are saying, aha, I told you so.
Yeah. You know, I never watched one of those TV shows, but I have been covering a lot of the natural disasters the past year, from the hurricanes in Texas and Florida and Puerto Rico and the wildfires in California. And, you know, we watch these things on TV and you say, wow, that's really horrible. But it things can happen. Everybody in the Northeast after Superstorm Sandy and the power outage for weeks, or I don't even know, maybe some people months. It's not such a bad thing to kind of have a practical sense of preparedness.
We're speaking with Laura Kelly, national and health reporter at The Washington Times. She's written an interesting piece entitled North Korea Nuclear Fears Boost Demand for Survivalist Gear and Services. How much does some of this stuff cost, by the way, these suits or the gas masks you mentioned?
Individual items, I'm not entirely certain, but I did see that because I was getting kind of interested in kind of these starter packs, something you could have in your closet and grab and go in case of an emergency.
Yeah.
So you can get a backpack filled with anywhere from between 10 and 30 items that could last you on your own for maybe 3 days. And those range in price from about $100 to about $500. Now, if you want to buy space in one of these bunkers, Vivo said that it's a down payment of about $25,000 and then annual payments of $1,000. And you can stock the bunker yourself and you know, spend as much money as you want to outfit it in a comfortable manner. Or you can pay, I'm not sure how much they charge, but he said they can outfit it to 4- and 5-star quality.
Wow. Thanks, Laura. Laura Kelly, national and health reporter at The Washington Times. 21 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, glad you could spend some time with us. Given the wild swings of the stock market lately, how prepared are you or your portfolio? Because as the professionals say, selling in a panic is not a good strategy. Things to consider about yourself and your accounts from Kelly Grant, consumer reporter at CNBC.com, also a certified financial planner. Kelly, explain the stress test.
Well, certainly you're probably feeling that stress, but it's a really good opportunity to take a look at your plan and just make sure you're comfortable with where you are. I mean, whenever we see the market, you know, with these different swings that are going on, you know, the big advice for your typical investor, this is somebody, you know, we're talking like long-term, you know, this is a lot of noise. This is not something that's going to or should make you have a lot of panicked moves. It's kind of the keep calm and carry on strategy.
What if this turns out to be, say, more than a correction, closer to, say, a bear market, which would be, what, a 20% drop, I guess?
So what you really want to be thinking about as we see, you know, if this is a continued dip, you know, it's a good opportunity if you have a plan, you know, that's, you know, again, we're sort of saying keep calm and carry on, because your plan inevitably is going to account for something like this if you have a good one. If you are feeling nervous about it, though, that's a good opportunity to pick up the phone and give a call to your financial advisor, whoever you're working with, to be able to say, hey, you know, what, if anything, should we be doing here? Does this change materially what our plan is? And if you don't have a plan, well, now would be the time to think about implementing one. Although that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, sell everything and hope for the best. That's really where you want to get the good financial advice from somebody who knows your particular risk tolerance, your time horizons, all of those different things, and can sort of tell you how do we protect and move forward.
What might that plan include if you don't have one?
Well, you know, obviously looking at a lot of that time horizon, too, for folks. I mean, we were talking to when the market was looking really good at the outset of this year, you know, sort of saying there's a point where if you're just a few years out from needing the money for that particular goal, where you really are better off not being in the market. But for most people, you know, that might be looking at, you know, just making sure that your allocations match up with your risk tolerance. You know, we see occasional releases from folks who, you know, they've found, especially as equities were doing well, that their portfolio was maybe a little more aggressive than they might have liked. Mm-hmm. But you have to take a look at that regularly to be able to see where you're at and making sure that you're in the right investments to meet your investment goals, but that you're not being unnecessarily aggressive if that's not something that you can handle and if news like this is going to make you panic.
We're speaking with Kelly Grant, consumer reporter at CNBC.com, also a certified financial planner. Is there a person or an individual who should not be in stocks at all?
Well, if you were looking at some sort of a short-term goal there, you're just, you know, a year or two out from retirement, or, you know, you're looking at, you know, say, pulling money because you want to buy a house or something like that, you know, that's where you'd really want to be talking to somebody. It's not to say for something like retirement that you shouldn't be in stocks at all, but maybe you want to have less of an aggressive allocation so that you're able to better preserve that money. For something like a short-term spending goal, you know, that really is where we would say, like, you shouldn't be putting money into the market for that generally. The time horizon that planners usually talk about, it's like 5 years or less or 4 years or less, where, you know, if you needed the money within then, for something like, you know, you're going to buy a house, an engagement ring, something big, you know, not best not to suddenly be losing a good chunk of your down payment.
If my recall is correct, I think there was a woman quoted in one of your stories who was sort of saying something along the lines of, repeat after me, right? I'm in this for the long term. Don't panic.
Exactly.
Thanks, Kelly. Kelly Grant, consumer reporter at CNBC.com. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. Hey, glad you could spend some time here. While U.S. professional skiers can stroll American streets unbothered, they are rock stars in European countries like Germany and Austria, where skiing is as popular as baseball is here. Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman says the ranks and organization of U.S. flag-waving European fans have swelled in recent years as several American skiing stars have emerged. Rachel, what have you found?
Well, although the United States has a great ski team, particularly women, they don't have a ton of fans relative to Europe, which is really the historic hub of alpine skiing, downhill skiing. So what I found is that a lot of, for instance, heads of the fan clubs of Lindsey Vonn and Michaela Schifrin, for instance, are actually in Germany and Austria and other places like that.
And so what do they do? What do these fan clubs do?
Well, sometimes they'll meet in person and go to you know, go to races. Most of the races are in Europe, and so it certainly is easier for them to get there than American fans. They do a lot of online stuff. One of the heads of the Michaela Schifrin fan club started a pretty elaborate YouTube page with highlight videos that he makes himself.
Wow.
And you know, they have Facebook pages, and in Michaela Schifrin's case, there's a fan club page that looks very much like sort of her official page. It's not her official page, but if you Google Michaela Schifrin fan club, you will land in this on this website that is run by two Germans.
Wow.
So, you know, Europeans are very into alpine skiing, and this includes U.S. skiers.
No kidding. So if you are a German who loves alpine skiing, you're cheering for your own country skiers, but if you're at a race, you're also cheering for the Americans?
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing I found out that's really interesting is Europeans understand that U.S. skiers don't get any direct government support, actually makes the U.S. unusual, because many European countries have governments that give direct funding to Olympians or potential Olympians. The U.S. doesn't do that. United States Olympic Committee is run through corporate sponsorships, donations, things like that. It gets no government money. And a lot of Europeans know this, and so they root on Americans, and in some cases, you know, underfunded Americans you've never heard of. And also, you know, they're pretty good. I mean, Lindsey Vonn is one of the greatest skiers of all time.
Yeah.
Michaela Schifrin is on her way to becoming that way. Ted Ligety, who also will be at these Olympics, is also a great skier. And so Europeans have really latched on to these Americans, both for their achievements and their personalities.
Mm, just like soccer. No, just kidding. The comment from Ted Ligety was funny because he said in your story, we're every country's second favorite team to root for.
That's true. Well, he made a good point, which is, you know, Austria is the kingpin in terms of alpine skiing. And so, you know, they're sort of like the New England Patriots of skiing. Like, other countries don't want to root for them. So if they're going to have another country they root for, they do root for the U.S., which, you know, historically, depending on the era, is sometimes an underdog in alpine skiing. You know, Austria has way more medals, and certainly the fan support in general is much higher in places like Germany and Norway and Sweden. So all this combines to make for kind of a fun team to root for, the sort of surprising underdog of Team USA.
Thanks, Rachel. Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman, who is in South Korea for the Olympics. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. In the months before the Olympics in South Korea, which is 14 hours ahead of the U.S. East Coast, sleep was such a point of emphasis for the U.S. Olympic Committee that many athletes went early to acclimate, but not the ski jumpers. They feel there might be value in not being mentally sharp. They believe it can calm their nerves. Ski jumpers say their sport is far more taxing on the brains than their bodies. After all, they fling themselves off a ginormous ramp and fly hundreds of yards through the air. That's why the Wall Street Journal says the strategy is to arrive in Pyeongchang only days before their events. They want to be a little out of their minds. Their schedule this week, for example, compete in Germany on Sunday, start their journey across the world on Monday, touch down in Seoul on Tuesday, train in Pyeongchang Wednesday, compete in Olympic qualifying Thursday before the first medal event on Saturday. The journal says they're not trying to avoid jet lag. They, in fact, are chasing jet lag. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.